This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Katie Balls. It's safe to say that the Brexit negotiations haven't gone exactly to plan. The Tories are down in the latest polls, but UKIP is up. Are we witnessing the beginning of UKIP's return? Meanwhile, Australians are stuck between a rock and a hard place as China and America continue to bicker, and Cosmo Landesman complains about modern parenting. You don't have to be following Brexit very closely to know that it could be going a bit better. May has lost the main Brexiteers in her cabinet, and Jacob Rees-Mogg is leading a Leavers revolt from the backbenches. If you voted for a hard Brexit, you would understandably be worried. Is this what explains a recent increase in UKIP's popularity in the polls? In this week's cover article, academic and UKIP expert Matthew Goodwin writes that the party is making a comeback. Matthew joins me now, together with Joe Twyman, pollster and director of Delta Poll. So Matthew, why are the UK Independence Party making a comeback?
Well, I think firstly, if you look at the opinion polls over the last week and a half, 2 weeks, we've certainly seen an uptick in support for UKIP. But I would argue that the broader currents at the moment are certainly flowing in that direction. We've got a high level of disillusionment among Conservatives with the Chequers deal on Brexit. We've got the polling at the weekend showing that around 38% of the country is saying it would be potentially up for a party that was unequivocally committed to Brexit. And we've got those unresolved grievances that led to Brexit in the first place that we're still not talking too much about: how to reform Britain's immigration policy, how to make our political system more representative of groups like the working class, and so on. So I think overall, the demand is certainly there. The million-dollar question is, can UKIP or a party like UKIP actually supply that demand with something credible and appealing?
Now, Joe, you're a bit of a polling expert. Do you sense that the winds are changing in UKIP's favour at the moment?
I think there, from the polling that we've seen over the last couple of weeks, there seems to definitely be a movement in UKIP's direction. But two important things to say about that. Firstly, we don't know if it will continue. It's too early to say whether this uptick, and we're talking about small numbers here, admittedly. I mean, they got, I think, 1.8% at the last election. They're now up to 6 in our latest poll at Delta Poll. But we don't know if that will continue. It may just be a temporary blip, and so we'll have to wait and see. The other thing is, we don't know if it will continue to grow. And so if they stay at 6%, I don't think that's necessarily enough to make a massive difference. But of course, in particular constituencies where the election is won and lost, it could make a difference. The wider polling around things such as attitudes towards the Chequers deal, I think, is the really interesting stuff, because as Matt said, that points to at least a potential for the foundations for some sort of anti-Brexit movement, whether that is a political party in the form of UKIP, whether that is a political protest organisation or something like that, remains to be seen. But it's clear that the Brexit deal, which the vast majority of people aren't actually paying attention to in terms of the specifics, but in terms of narratives around it, it's not playing particularly well. There hasn't been yet a really powerful, winning, viable alternative in terms of public opinion. So we wait and see on that.
And Matthew, Joe is right in the sense that it doesn't seem that UKIP are gaining traction because of anything they're doing actively. It seems to be more because of things the Tories are doing badly in voters' eyes. Is that right?
I think that's true. One of the quotes that I use in the piece is the old Richard Hofstadter comment about challenger parties. Now, he was talking about American politics, but he said that they're a bit like bees. Once they've stung the political system, they tend to die. And I think that assumption has run through our debate in Britain, which is pretty much from 2013 onwards, UKIP was always going to collapse, and it sort of never really did until we got all the way to the referendum and then the vote for Brexit. So I think there are a number of interesting things happening now. That one is the Chequers deal and the reaction to that. But I think also there's this space in British politics where, you know, you've seen pretty influential social media activists, Paul Joseph Weston, Raheem Kassam, people like that, who have now been saying to their not insignificant numbers of followers, we're talking 800,000, 900,000 people in the case of Weston, saying, well, you should join the UK Independence Party, not from a classically Eurosceptic position, but from a we are anti-political correctness, pro-freedom of speech position, and also PS, don't really like Islam, don't really like refugees, don't really like feminism. So, you know, there's a sort of additional layer to UKIP now that I think there wasn't even 2, 3, 4 years ago.
Yeah, and in your piece you say that the new UKIP will be distinctly less cuddly. Is that what you mean by that?
That's exactly what I mean by that. I mean, Gerard Batten is a completely different entity from Nigel Farage. He's willing to talk to Tommy Robinson. He's willing to be very vocal on the issue of Islam. He is far more to the right than Nigel Farage was, if that makes sense. Now, that introduces a question which Joe alluded to, which is, you know, will UKIP in its current form be able to go from being an 8-9% party to being what it was in earlier years, potentially, which was a 15-17% party? And I think ultimately UKIP always struggled with winning over the middle class, winning over women, winning over ethnic minorities, winning over more liberal sections of the population. Batten, I don't think, will be able to do that. But if he makes way for somebody like Farage in the future with a bad Brexit deal and conservative divisions, then maybe they'll have a second run at that. But I wouldn't currently predict where we're going to be in 6 months.
I think there's an interesting question to be had about these new alt-right, if you want to characterise them as that, internet professional contrarians is one way of putting it. Internet trolls is another way of looking at it. And Matt's right that you could argue that they're getting involved for ideological reasons. But the counter-argument about it, that is, they're getting involved because of the, to use the parlance of internet trolling, they're getting involved because of the lols. They think it will be fun and a bit of a laugh. Quite how funny it proves to be. My sense is probably not laugh out loud funny, but exactly how funny it proves to be for them, I think, could actually have quite a big impact on this thing. If they start to get momentum because of it and think, oh, actually, you know, we can take over the party here and we can build this in our own image, then I think that's a really interesting pathway for that thing to go down. If alternatively they get bored within 10 minutes and move on to the next thing, then that's something very different entirely, and we don't know.
And we've touched on these kind of figures, big social media presences. Joe, do you think social media plays a big role in changing people's opinion?
I think it's really easy to overstate the power that social media has in terms of influencing people's opinions. When you ask people where they get their information about politics and public affairs, still television comes top for most people. And there is, of course, the argument, okay, well, where do the people in television get their information from? Where do the newspapers get theirs from? It all comes from Twitter and so on and so forth. But I think there's definitely the potential for these things to have an impact, but it's not, I don't think, going to be the game changer in this case, particularly as a lot of UKIP's members, as I understand it, are relatively old, not particularly net, compared to other parties, not particularly net savvy. And yes, there's a group within that obviously are, but whether they'll go beyond that, I don't know. But there's a lot of talk about new parties, not just new parties, not new movements, not just the return of UKIP, but the idea of a new centrist party, etc., etc., etc. And a lot of that is predicated on the polls saying, oh, well, people will support a new party that adopts this policy position. But we know from a lot of the work that's been done that people don't actually think like that in most cases when it comes to new parties. Instead, they think about leaders, they think about the party machinery, whether they can trust them, whether they think it's effective, that sort of thing.
Just briefly on that, I think we also need to remember that where we are in British politics now in the current cycle, I don't think UKIP is a new party anymore in the sense that we know that 70% of Leave voters said that they had voted UKIP or would consider to vote UKIP. And we also know from research at Oxford and elsewhere that levels of overall volatility in British politics, meaning people switching their votes from one election to the next, are the highest that they've been in the post-war period. So you've got some Labour going Conservative, some Lib Dem going Labour, some UKIP going Conservative, now some Conservatives going back the other way to UKIP. So the tribalism that we had in earlier years, I don't think is there, which conceivably could make it easier for smaller challenger parties like UKIP. Would an anti-Brexit party, a centrist party work? I'm less convinced, because I think the advantage that a party like UKIP has is that its votes are concentrated in working class constituencies where typically average levels of education are quite low and concerns over issues like immigration are very high. An anti-Brexit centrist party would have the exact same problem that the SDP had, which is their votes are very spread, are spread very thinly across constituencies. They might take a few university towns, a couple of London seats, but they wouldn't be able to get up into those big numbers.
But there's no doubt that the electoral system still scuppers any new parties.
Now, while we're not sure what exactly this means for UKIP or centrist parties that are new, it does seem that this seems to be very bad news for the Conservatives. In your piece, Matthew, you say that today's Tory voters are different to the electorate that Cameron faced in 2015. They're much more pro-Brexit, particularly a hard Brexit, the more anti-immigration, and the more socially conservative. Do you think there's a chance of that changing, or is this really who the Conservatives are going to have to try and win over at the next election?
So I've been talking to quite a few Conservatives over the last couple of weeks, and to be honest, it amazes me how out of touch they are with the extent to which that their electorate has changed. I mean, in only 3 years, the Conservative Party electorate in general terms has become more pro-Brexit, more working class, more traditionally socially conservative, more anxious over immigration. And so what we've seen is a partial realignment in British politics, while Labour has become more dependent upon the liberal middle class, professionals, university graduates. Now, where do you think Britain is going to go depends on your interpretation. You might argue that what we are going to see, similar to the US, some other Western democracies, is a full-scale realignment over a period of time where you will get the Conservatives hoovering up that kind of more blue-collar, socially conservative part of Britain, and you'll see Labour, like the Democrats, increasingly becoming dependent upon university towns, kind of middle-class bastions, that sort of thing. I think the Conservative Party now has a real trade-off. On the one hand, it's how do you keep Jeremy Corbyn out of power? Well, in the current electoral cycle, if you're being devil's advocate, you'd say to, you know, Theresa May or Boris Johnson or Jacob Rees-Mogg, whoever ends up in charge, you're never going to win back. My students in Canterbury, for example, that went Jeremy Corbyn, and you're never going to win back London, and you're never going to win back the university towns. So the short-term dilemma is, how do you maximise turnout among those new groups, and then over 2-3 election cycles, how do you rebuild a coalition that might include some of those groups like liberal middle-class seats, Kensington and Chelsea, that sort of thing? That's a dilemma that they face, and currently, I don't really think they have an answer to it.
Joe, is that something you pick up too when you do these polling samples, that Liberal voters perhaps are moving away from the Conservatives?
Yes, that's true. I agree with what Matt says. But of course, the great uncertainty here is Brexit and how that plays out. Because in polling, what we're always looking at are the social cleavages in society. So these lines which divide us as a society. And in previous years, it's always been about class. Every A-level student who studied politics has probably answered an essay about that at some stage or another, and the impact that class has on British voting. For a long time, newspaper readership was this big division. You had the Telegraph readers versus the Guardian readers. Now, of the new cleavages that have emerged, you have things like university-educated people versus people who are not university-educated, but the major emerging thing is Brexit and Remainers and Leavers. At the moment, you have 7 out of 10 people thinking that Brexit should take place, either because they voted for it first time around, or they think that democracy should be upheld and the results should be respected. But that's in theory. When the deal is finally struck, and not the deal that the Conservatives strike, but the actual deal with the EU that's finally negotiated, they may find, they being the political class, may find that these social cleavages just tear apart. And you've got Remainers and Leavers irreconcilable. That may not be the case, but the point is we don't know, and it's this huge uncertainty that casts a cloud over all of the political structures in Britain at the moment.
Now, I know we don't like to do too many predictions, but Matthew, given your wisdom, do you think there is some form of Brexit deal the Conservatives could go for that would keep the UKIP-type voters on side and steer them to power in the next election?
Well, the first thing to say is there's no Brexit deal in my mind that would simultaneously satisfy the UKIP true blue end of the Conservative electorate with the middle class, socially liberal end of the Conservative electorate. But there is certainly one that would appeal to the current Conservative electorate, which, as I mentioned, has become very different from 2015. And that is to leave the single market, to leave the customs union, and to deliver meaningful reform over freedom of movement. Those are basically the three key things that Conservatives associate with real Brexit. Now, of course, that has all kinds of implications, economic, political, constitutional, but it's quite clear from the survey and polling work, at least that I've looked at, that the Conservative voters are looking for what you might call a relatively clean break from the European Union. It's also worth mentioning, by the way, that in most trade-off scenarios, Conservative voters pretty routinely prioritise the reform of freedom of movement over continued access to free markets. So I think it's pretty clear what they want, and that's why we've seen this incredibly high level of dissatisfaction with the Chequers deal, which many Conservative voters looked at and thought, this is a fudge, this isn't what we're after. And of course, you know, the one thing we know about these voters is that they have defected away from the Conservative Party to get what they want in the past, and they will probably do so again.
And moving back to UKIP and their chances of success if they can capitalise on this movement, there's a lot of talk of the fact they might need a new leader, not Gerard Batten, and this could be found in Nigel Farage. Matt, do you think that sounds viable? Do you think that's something that will happen?
In the world of UKIP, you can't predict anything. It's certainly plausible. Batten's leadership is due to run out in March 2019. Interestingly, that coincides with Article 50 deadline. Farage has already said that if Article 50 is extended, he will commit to campaigning full time. And he said that if the Chequers deal stands or Brexit is betrayed as he sees it, then he will look to replace Batten as the leader. I think if he ultimately decides that's what he wants to do, he will get it. He will be pushed forward not only by traditional social conservatives, but also large parts of the media who do not see Batten as a credible spokesperson for that wing of British politics. But there are lots of UKIP insiders who I've spoken to over the last week and a half, and I mentioned this in the piece, who are actually saying they're not entirely convinced that Farage necessarily should come back because they think that he vacated the pitch over the last 2 years, that he let Boris and Jacob Rees-Mogg take over, or that he stopped fighting the corner of Brexit. They're also angry about his media work and the fact that he's not been telling all of his LBC listeners and his Twitter followers to go and join UKIP. And they're deeply anxious over some of the people that he associates with, namely Aaron Banks, who they view as being highly divisive and not good for party unity. At the end of the day, the old rule in UKIP has always been what Nigel wants, Nigel gets. And I think ultimately, if he decides he wants to come back, he'll come back.
Joe, is Nigel what the people want?
I think Nigel is definitely what the media want. It's very convenient to have a very eloquent, very entertaining, for in inverted commas, spokesperson for that wing of British politics. In fact, even if you characterise it as a, if you do characterise it as a wing, he is certainly a popular figure among his supporters. But crucially, he's also very unpopular among his detractors, and that makes for good TV. That makes for good radio, as his radio show has shown. He's certainly more of an effective electoral force, I think, than Gerard Batten. But we will see. I agree with Matt. I think it will depend on what Nigel wants. I can't really see a UKIP conference or NEC or however it works, saying, no, Nigel, actually, thanks for all your efforts, but we don't want you back. I just can't see that happening. For most people who aren't paying that much attention to politics, UKIP and Nigel Farage are synonymous with one another, and it would be cutting off your entire head to spite your face to turn him away.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Matthew.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Australia is facing a crossroads moment. For years, it has been under the protective wing of America. But in recent decades, China, its main trading partner, has started to stand on its own 2 feet, and some say, aggressively push into its backyard. Meanwhile, Trump has started a trade war with China, and President Xi hasn't flinched away from retaliation. So, where does this leave Australia? That's the question that Tom Switzer, veteran broadcaster and the executive director for the Centre for Independent Studies, asks in this week's magazine. Tom joins me now, together with Meriden Varel, director of the East Asia Programme at the Lowy Institute. Tom, in this week's magazine, you write that Australia is living in interesting times. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that we're at a very interesting stage in our history. Since we became an independent state in 1901, Australia's political leaders, the public at large, have always believed that it's in our national interest to be very much engaged with a great and powerful friend that shares our values and interests. So for the first half of the 20th century, that great power, of course, was Great Britain. And since the end of World War II, and especially since the onset of the Cold War, that great power has been the United States. But now we're in this very tricky situation where we have the rise of China, which means different things to the United States and to Australia. For the United States, it's the emergence of a geopolitical rival. And for Australia, it is basically our largest commercial and trade partner. And so we have to ride these two horses simultaneously, and that's a very delicate diplomatic task.
Meriden, you're a China expert. Is it the intention, do you think, of the Chinese government to try and bring Australia further under its sphere of influence?
I'd say that it was certainly the Chinese government's hope that they could decouple Australia a little bit from what they see as Australia's kind of automatic connection to US foreign policy. They see Australia as very much basically cowing to any demands or commands that the US makes of Australia in terms of its international relations. And they would definitely like to try and pull Australia away from that.
Tom, how are Australians feeling about the country's relationship with China? Is it something that is well received in the country?
Well, let's be frank. I mean, we've had 27 years of uninterrupted economic growth. And many economists believe that for the second half of that bull run, it's largely due to China's lust for our commodities. I think there's a lot of truth to be said for that. But at the same time, as Lowy Institute polling makes very clear, Australians are very uneasy. They're a bit nervous about China's rise. I mean, let's face it, it doesn't share our values. It still remains a communist dictatorship. And in the course of the last year or so, there have been a lot of allegations of Beijing's interference in Australian politics. There's fears that the government in Beijing are putting pressures via proxies on in universities, undermining academic freedom. So you've got polls like the Lowy Institute poll that shows that three quarters of Australians say that our government allows, quote, too much investment from China. Never mind that foreign investment from China has helped us weather the financial crisis from 10 years ago. So we are in a bind.
Yeah, and making things even more complicated, Meriden, is the fact that Trump and China's Xi are pretty much engaged in a trade war right now. Do you think China and America's relationship makes things more difficult for Australia?
That's absolutely right. I mean, when we're talking about this question about what Australia's going to do, and, you know, there's a broader issue here about whether or not Australia can choose, but in the confines of this question about our relationship with China, the worse the relationship between China and the US is, the harder it is for Australia to negotiate, because as Tom writes in his article, the two horses are getting further apart, so it's harder to straddle. If those two horses are riding along nicely together, of course it's much easier for Australia to navigate that relationship.
Tom, you touched on this earlier, but there's this feeling, you know, that Australia has always had a country that it relies on closely. As you say, it used to be Britain, then the US, and now we're having a tussle between the US and China. Does it have to be this way? Do you think this is a point where perhaps Australia is able to strike out on its own?
Oh, well, look, opinion varies on that very question. I mean, there are certainly some scholars in Australia who think that for too long, Australia has been a lickspittle of these, as Robert Menzies called them, great and powerful friends. This is an argument you'll mainly find on the ideological and the political left. But the reality is that both sides of politics in Canberra, both the federal government, the Conservative government of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, and the Labor opposition of Bill Shorten, are unashamed supporters of the US alliance. And that's largely been because we don't have to spend that much on defence. We spend anywhere between 1 to 2% of our GDP, of our economic output, on defence. And the great fear is that if we did lose the alliance, just as the New Zealanders did 30 years ago, taxpayers would have to pay a higher amount of money and taxes for our own defence. The other point to bear in mind is that thanks to the US alliance, Australia does benefit a lot in terms of intelligence, in terms of defence equipment. And if we didn't have that, we would, as Tony Abbott, a former Prime Minister, recently argued at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, we would have to start spending more on defence and being more assertive about protecting our own security. We're not used to that.
Yeah, and Tom, I mean, as you say, it might actually be something that Australia doesn't have much of a choice in on defence, because as you say in the piece, America does appear to be turning inwards, is pivoting away from Australia, and we see Trump having this America first, quite protectionist approach. Do you think if the president were to change, that would help Australia?
Oh, well, that's a great hope of among many Australians, that Trump is an aberration. My own sense about Trump is, perhaps this is wishful thinking, I think America is less likely to be focused on Europe because, let's face it, Russia is not a great geopolitical threat to Europe the way that, say, the Soviet Union was. And given that America has been badly bruised, you know, it's humiliated, it's lost a lot of blood and treasure in the Middle East, I don't think the Middle East or the Persian Gulf will be a main priority for the United States in coming years. What should be, and I think will be, a priority for the United States is East Asia, because clearly here we have a rising hegemon that threatens the status quo, the equilibrium, the balance of power. And the great fear now is that China will try to do to the Americans in East Asia what the Americans did to the European powers in the 19th century. And to the extent that that happens, my sense is you'll have a lot of states in the region, not just Australia, but South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, Thailand, even Cold War foes like Vietnam, even perhaps India, all joining the United States to be a counterweight to the rising China. That's a possibility we should take seriously.
And Meriden, before China can gain more influence, it has many domestic issues that it does need to sort out itself first, doesn't it? When you look at the huge demographic, environmental and economic issues that could strangle its own growth.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And when we're looking at, you know, China's outward behaviour, and we're thinking about this, what looks like territorial expansionism or imperial ambitions, we need to very much focus on what those political domestic drivers are. And at the core of everything is Communist Party's continued legitimacy. And the two main pillars that rests on is continued economic development and a sort of sense of national pride and national identity, and territory and sovereignty are a big part of that. And so if you have a domestic population who feels that their economic and their livelihoods and their well-being is not improving, or they feel that their national rejuvenation project is not being met, they're going to become restless and dissatisfied and question the legitimacy of the regime. So there's that political component. But apart from that, yes, as you said, you've got this demographic challenge, the aging of the population, a huge issue. You've got the environmental concerns. You know, China's enormous growth in the last while has been based on a fairly, you know, an ultimately unsustainable model that can't continue, that the environmental damage has been absolutely enormous, that can't go on, and Chinese people are dissatisfied with that. There are so many of these kind of domestic drivers to what China does internationally. And of course, there's the just general politicking as well. You know, we have this image of Xi Jinping as the all-powerful Wizard of Oz controlling everything. You know, he's taken a lot of the levers of power, for sure, but that doesn't mean there's not disgruntled politics going on behind the scenes as well. There's pushback and there's tensions there too that Xi and has to deal with, and that pushes certain behaviours internationally.
Now, finally, moving back to our domestic front, we're currently in the midst of Brexit, and I wonder if you think that will have any influence on the position Australia is in. Tom, do you think Britain leaving the European Union could be a chance for us to be Australia's best friend again?
Well, that's not inconceivable. I mean, 50 years ago, in 1968, the British withdrew its military presence east of Suez, you know, from the Pacific. And taken together with Richard Nixon's decision to call on US allies in the region, this is in the wake of Vietnam, to do more to protect themselves, this led to a sense of anxiety and a sense of abandonment in Australia. Now the irony is 50 years later, we've got the British leaving Europe to become more integrated back into the Asia Pacific. So it's quite conceivable that Australia and Britain will become closer in the next 10 to 20 years.
Do you agree with that, Meriden?
Look, I agree that we will definitely get closer, you know, now that Britain's going out on its own. But in terms of being Australia's best friend again, I think this goes right back to the sort of the first question that we had here when Tom was talking about our long history since 1901, national interest to be engaged with great and powerful friends. We keep thinking like that. Our most recent white paper is really based on that premise of desperately hoping that our current great and powerful friend will remain so. And, you know, if that doesn't work out, you know, yeah, maybe we're going to look for another one. But the UK doesn't have the economic clout, the political clout, the security clout that could possibly replace the US. And Australia needs to not even think in those terms. We have to really move into the new reality that's happening around us, that these kinds of great and powerful friends just aren't going to be our old kind of colonial friends or English heritage background peers. We need to look for the realities of the region, the politics that is happening now, and forget about that kind of alliance.
I have to say, as a former editor of the Australian Spectator, I have an interest in supporting the British-Australia alliance.
Thank you, Meriden. Thank you, Tom.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
So, school's out for the summer, but one person who's not happy about this is Cosmo Landesman. It seems that his part of London, at least, has been flooded, no, invaded, by little humans and their parents. What's more, they're always awfully behaved. It's nice to let your kids express themselves and all, Cosmo writes, but what's the deal with letting them run wild? Cosmo joins the podcast to air his grievances, all for a group counselling session, together with Henry Jeffries, writer and father to a six-year-old. Cosmo, you spotted a problem with the holidays, haven't you?
Yes, it's called children. And we've got to do something about it. There are too many of them. They're going to ruin the summer holiday this year unless we take decisive action.
Do you think the number of children is on the rise, or is it the behaviour?
Well, that's an interesting question. This whole thing started when I used to call myself, you know, a baby lover. I loved babies. A beaming baby cheered up my day. And I noticed there's this new breed of baby that is always crying. And in my neighbourhood, which was a kind of cool neighbourhood at one time, has become Nappy Valley. And everywhere you go, there are mums and prams. And mums with prams have taken over my entire neighbourhood. I'm not prejudiced. There's just too many of them. That's the real problem of it.
Now, Henry, you're a father to a toddler. Are you going to say something in defence of these young adults?
Yeah, well, she's six now, so she's actually a kind of a little girl. Well, I think the problem is the grown-ups rather than the children. I think it's the adults, it's their responsibility. If they're going to take their children to a public place, such as a pub, they need to discipline the children.
Well, that's what's happened. That's the key change, is the power balance is now changed, where you're expected to fit into other people's children. When I was a young father, we had to fit our children into adults and their needs. So, for example, if you're in a restaurant and your child is screaming its head off, it's up to you to take the child out, calm it down, and then bring it back. Now you have to go out, calm down at their annoyance, and then find another table.
Yes, but I think it depends on the restaurant. I think you have specific restaurants like Giraffe, which are designed for that kind of thing.
So they can have that.
If you want
they
a bit of peace and quiet,
give me back my other restaurant.
Exactly. I think some grown-ups confuse going to the Ivy with going to Giraffe. So they behave as if they're in Giraffe the whole time.
We'll give you the Giraffe if you give us the Ivy back.
So what I think we need to do is we need to take back control of these adult spaces. So an alliance of parents, landlords...
But there are no adult spaces left anymore. The kids have taken them over.
And Henry, isn't it the case that when we're looking at these safe spaces that Cosmo so desperately needs, that you're actually guilty of taking your children to pubs?
Well, the thing is I don't want to blow my own trumpet here, or my daughters or my wife. We have one child who's 6 years old, and she has been drilled in the ways of behaving in a pub. From the age of about 3 months, we took her to the pub, and everyone used to pass her around, and she learned. And as soon as she cried, we took her outside. She plays cards. She lets me have three pints.
Did she buy a round?
I was trying to teach her to buy around. She's a bit nervous about it.
But a cheap child. They're the worst.
But she's very, very well behaved. And as soon as she behaves badly, we leave.
That doesn't matter. I'm sorry. I'm not going to give you points for that, because I don't want to see a child in a pub. I don't want to get pissed and try and chat up women with a child looking at me saying, "Oi, you, granddad, stop it." Because that's what they do. You know, they're very judgmental children. It's not a good place for them to be in. It's an adult atmosphere.
Yes. Well, I had a very difficult childhood. I spent most of my time sitting in the back of a car eating crisps and orange, drinking orange juice.
While my father
went to the pub. Sometimes we didn't even allow women in.
And
so
you
my mother
turned
would
out
be,
very nicely, Henry. You're a perfect
I, no,
example.
No, no, no,
this.
No. You
they
should
kept
talk
you
to my therapist.
The
it's been awful. So this has been a trauma in my life. So I don't want my daughter to go through this. So I take her into the pub. But I appreciate some people don't like it. So I always say to the landlord, is it all right if she comes in? And if they say, get out because Cosmo's here, then I just go, fine, we'll go to the Dog and Bell up the road.
Maybe you just need to buy a pub, Cosmo. But going back to some of these points, I mean, in your piece, obviously you're saying that children are undisciplined and they need to learn basic manners to some degree. But don't you think it's kinder to allow children the opportunity to express themselves through playing and running?
Absolutely not. Don't do that. Self-expression is better. I mean, we've gone, you know, the old days of the children should be seen and not heard. Okay, of course, that's too extreme. But we've gone back completely the other way, where children should be seen, heard, celebrated, boosted all the time. And I think that is equally indulgent and bad. We've got to find a right balance. And the pendulum has completely swung the wrong way.
No, I'm afraid I have to agree with that, because my daughter's cool. They give them praise for absolutely everything. Oh, yeah. And some of them are just terrible. I mean, terrible at drawing. They can't add up. They can't, you know, they can't write.
And it's a subsequent, what has happened is now everybody thinks their children are absolutely fascinating to everybody else. Yes. I mean, you go on Facebook and all your friends with their little finger paintings and their little cute sayings that aren't cute. Stop it. We don't want to hear about your kids.
Anyway, as a parent, would you be upset if a restaurant told you you couldn't bring your children there?
No, not at all. No, I would be. I always ask, especially if it's a smart place. I always say, do you mind if we bring the child in? And they almost always say that's absolutely fine. So I think it's a courtesy if you're taking a child into an adult space.
But do you ask the people at the table opposite you? No, you don't.
No, I don't. But I sort of go with what the owner, manager, landlord says.
So, Cosmo, given that this is your manifesto to rid the capital specifically, but then I guess you'll go nationwide in reducing the number of spoilt children in restaurants, how do you plan to do this? What do you think the restaurateurs, the pub owners should be doing, and parents should be doing?
I think as citizens, we need to take a stand. If more people were grumpy like me and said, enough, get your kid out of the bar, get your kid out of the restaurant, get your kid out of first class, we create an environment where this would slowly move out through the rest of society.
But I think it's about educating the grown-ups. I think it's about...
Like there are no bad dogs, there are only bad owners.
Exactly, yes. So they need to be... Maybe they could have night classes.
I agree with you.
For adults. Do you say adult place, giraffe. You know, yeah, and this is the difference.
And a giraffe wants to sponsor this podcast.
The only thing that I disagreed with in your piece was you mentioned how we're becoming like French people who are very indulgent to their children. I find the French aren't very indulgent. The French tend to be, or the old-fashioned French, very disciplined and very kind of... French children tend to sit up straight and to know how to behave in bistros.
Well, that's a new trend, because in the old days, it was always the thing about the English hate children because they don't want them in restaurants. And now we've let them into restaurants and we really hate them.
Yes, but I think the French have always had a good attitude towards children because they like them, but they teach them how to behave like adults. Yeah. Whereas the Italians are just, you know, all over the place with that.
Exactly.
Thanks, Cosmo. Thanks, Henry. And that's all for this week. If you enjoyed this podcast, do subscribe, rate and review on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you. Also remember to pick up this week's issue to read all the pieces discussed in the podcast, as well as Boris Johnson's diary, Tim Shipman on the new Brexit TV show, and more. And we also have a special summer offer. Simply go to spectator.co.uk/summer to access 1 month of The Spectator online for free. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.